keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. I'm in it. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. It is all it is. Anyway, this is a Wednesday, beautiful Wednesday afternoon. This is like we up to the second week of the month already. Lord, yeah. Is the time going by? Are y'all getting old out there or what? You know, I say y'all. I say y'all too. It's just hard to believe it's almost the middle of the month. Seems like we just said hello. It's, you know, August. And, you know, Lord. So, anyway. And just unbelievable. And, you know, before we know it, it's going to be Halloween and stuff. And everybody already has your mask. Do a little mask humor for the masquerade ball. Yeah, it's coming, y'all. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be right, act right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's coming. We've been, you know, a lot of us that wear them that are conscious of health and the significance of it. We're so used to it now. It ain't no deal.
Yeah.
You know. And, you know, you just used to it.
It just becomes automatic.
Yeah. I mean, it's just put it on, take it off when you look around the thighs, you know. It's the motion. Can you imagine all of the mental energy and emotion that people have used in these last 6 months around a mask?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, y'all used up enough emotion lotion to grease up the country. I mean, you know, you just got all whack. Just, you know, just was no need for that. So, and they are different fabric. You know, is warmer or hotter. You know, have you noticed that?
Yeah, depending on what you have on.
Well, but, I'm just saying, like, breathing.
Yeah.
Because I have, I noticed this. I did an experiment. We had those, we got those white CDC masks.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are thicker.
Yeah, and tighter.
Than the mask that came from the Metro Health Department. Mm-hmm. And they allow you to breathe just a little better, and they stretch your, yeah, so, you know, that makes a difference. You're easy in, easy out.
Yeah. I like this one because I can just tie it and just leave it.
Right.
And if I step outside,
I see how you do it.
So, yeah, it's much easier.
Yeah, I see how you're doing.
Because before I walk, oh, man, I left it on my desk. Right. Oh, man, I left it on, you know, so, yeah.
I see you.
Yeah.
You have it tied around your neck and then flip it up.
Just flip it up. It down. Tie the top part.
Yeah. Like a pair of bib overalls.
Yeah.
And I see it. I see that. Because I know the first one I got, this, like, my sister, one of her sorority sisters was making masks. And, you know, anything to help her sorority sisters, okay?
Yeah.
Girl, I need you to place this order. I'm like, okay. I'm going to buy 10, and then I'll give them to the kids and everything. Because you couldn't find any.
That's true. For a while, you couldn't find a mask anywhere.
She had turned her house, retirement, and had her house into mask making.
Yeah.
And
now they're everywhere.
And then, you know, you tell one or two Deltas, and everybody in the country knows.
Yeah.
So, you know, my sister immediately was like, you better get you some of these, girl. Yeah.
The trick to those is making them original.
Yeah. Well, these at the time were just fabric that she had at her house because she sold.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, it was good at first, but it's tight.
Yeah.
You know, no stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you wear them, you want some stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But, at the time, it was pitch perfect because, I mean, you couldn't find nothing anywhere.
Yep.
Didn't matter. So you were just glad to have it, you know. But since the variety, you know, has come in, and like when my son got married, I had some, after the seamstress altered my dress, I had some fabric left, and because I don't believe in wasting anything.
Yeah.
So I told her I wanted her to make me a couple, you know, out of this. And it just wasn't wide enough. So she had something close to it that it matched. See, I wanted to match my dress.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't been dressed up in about a year. Or two or five.
As John Witherspoon would say, you got to coordinate.
Yeah, oh, I was completely, completely coordinated. As my children said, we ain't never seen you dressed up like this before, Mama. So I'm sure y'all haven't. You know, I'm a working person. I don't have time for fun. Not now. Later. I got to get a check. I got to get paid so I can, you know, maintain my life. But I mean, I see a lot of people coordinating now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making fashion statements. Nancy Pelosi,
yeah,
has a different mask on her outfits, mm-hmm, every day.
They match.
And it's probably just a scarf. But the point is that she sets the tone every single day for the house, man.
Right.
Yeah, don't y'all come in here all tacky. Every day she has on it, you know, I'm like, man.
So how long before you think the Biden-Harris mask comes out?
Tonight.
It'll be in the email.
Yeah. Or JB.
Yeah.
On one side. And KH on the other side. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tonight they working on that fundraiser right now. And, you know, as she said today when they got together and had their first get-together after the announcement yesterday, as far as the president is concerned, that's an open and shut case. I'm like, that's deep. It's like,
yep.
Cut. It's like done. Open and shut case. And a prosecutor would certainly know that now, don't you think?
Yep.
But that was, you know, wow. The how you think they're going to do? I know, but I mean, seriously.
If... And nothing ever goes 100% according to plan.
No.
But if they're able to execute at least 60% of what they should be able to do, this election will be a wrap for the Biden-Harris ticket. Just at 60%. Mm-hmm. With the mobilization of women everywhere, women of color, the demographics that she's able to reach, the coalition she's able to build, and so many areas, so many fronts. And that's adding to what he was already doing before,
right,
he announced today.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be, and just reading from the screen, the things that they said at this press conference, they're getting ready to go after Trump.
Well, and rightly so.
Yeah.
You know, nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
You all know that in life, right? Stuff just doesn't, you can't do clown stuff forever. It's going to catch up with you. He's no different. Okay? Trump is no different. He's not Jesus. Okay?
I don't know.
He's
now.
Not the
There's
Savior.
Some folk out there might disagree with
well,
you.
Well, they very well might, but he's not the yeah. Savior. He didn't hang on the cross and become and resurrect, okay? On the third day. It just didn't work yeah. like that. And you know, there's no behavior, no Christian behavior. I mean, I don't see any Christ-like tendencies.
Paula,
you know.
Paula White might disagree.
Well, you know, that's why.
Religious right might disagree.
They might. That's why I don't follow them, you know, because we're going to disagree.
Yeah.
And we're going to disagree because they know that stuff is not right. They know it's not right. They know it's not right. Because that same measuring stick has been used against the other side since the beginning. So now the thing, shoe is on the other foot. And there's no measuring stick.
Yeah. And another thing that will happen starting today is for the first time in 3 years, with the exception of major things that maybe President Obama have come out to say, that there's going to be an opposite voice to match the madness on the right. Mm-hmm. He's been able to stand there and go and have press conferences and spew out whatever he wants unchallenged, unchecked, especially by his own party.
Yes.
And so there's been no one to push back or say that's not right.
Those are the enablers.
Now, yeah. And now that this ticket, especially probably after the after the convention next week, there will be a voice that will get equal time, as much equal time as they can get, unless he steals it by having a set-up, a made-up press conference on the White House someplace and call it a press conference, which really it won't be. But you'll get to hear the other side. And like she said, the open and shut case, she'll begin to prosecute him, and he's not faced that before.
Well, and see, here's a couple things that have really crossed my mind. Now, first, I want to tell you, Jennifer Cobina will be with us in about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So we're not just playing volleyball, okay? Yeah. She is a professor, so, you know, we got to work around her. okay, now here's what generally happens in the playbook. And this is when, you know, it's called ball of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There is a section in the playbook under ball of confusion. Okay. it's going to start with some disgruntled sister on the internet that puts up, she's not black enough. Yeah. Oh, Lord, here it comes. Her hair, she got good hair. Let's see your naps. Here it comes. you're married to such and such. Oh, and she ain't, you know. Oh, Lord. I mean, this going to come from there. Why she wear pantsuits all the time? Mm. Well, she ain't got no dresses. Okay, y'all know it's going to be a disgruntled sister that could have been paid like Diamond and Silk. You know.
She'll end up on Fox News.
Okay.
They'll dig her up and put her on.
Yeah, they're going to find that person is going to, you know, they're coming. I wish she'd do something by her fingernails. Okay, Lord, help us, Jesus. You know, just,
I feel sorry.
She can't fry chicken.
I feel sorry for that person.
Okay.
I do.
Well, good, because they sit and they trolling.
I've already seen.
That's coming. It's coming.
I can't name all the people that I've seen on the various programs, but there is a coalition of black women and women in general.
Yeah.
That are standing by waiting to combat that in anybody that's going to try and pit sister against sister or bring the woman down. And there, what's the late? Oh my God.
Okay, see, you thought that was the case with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Okay. You thought that was the case with him.
They said they're waiting.
But they were waiting then too. But honey, that stuff was so stank and rank. And our community.
Yeah.
Was sitting there feeding it. And you know, y'all need to tell the truth and shame the devil on this. Because our community was feeding it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
I know a black pastor. And I won't dare say it on the air because I support this
ticket.
Well,
write it down after the show.
And I'll tell you during the break. I'll tell you during the break.
Okay.
And he's a prominent black pastor that went after her. But this was way before. This is why she was running, you know, in the beginning. So I would love to hear his stats
that
now.
I'm familiar with?
He's not been on the show, but you know his name. He doesn't live in Nashville.
Okay.
Yeah. He doesn't live in Nashville. But I went to a workshop, and I was like, wow. I'll tell you during the break exactly what he said. I wonder what he's got to say now.
Well, it doesn't matter if he doesn't support her.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, see, from that front will come all the stuff from Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll be the Russian trolls. Okay,
yeah.
They will say her and Biden had a relationship, or she, I mean, it's coming. It is coming. And so don't be
surprised.
Yeah, it's coming. I mean, you just think back at the garbage that we saw when it was Barack Obama. Just think about that,
yeah.
Okay? That he's not even American. he's not, doesn't have, you know, he's an illegal alien. He's, his daddy ain't black. And
he wasn't born here.
Right. And all, I mean, they almost like, man, his education is fake. And, you know, I mean, y'all know it's coming. Okay. Watch the Fox Network cable. Because they're going to be spewing.
Yeah.
They're going to be spewing like a volcano. Just watch. And then you'll, you know, or you already know what's coming. I mean, social media.
Yeah.
Going to be up all night popping popcorn and talking trash. Okay. That's coming. That is coming. I don't like her because she thinks she this. She ain't got no twists in her hair. Now, she should have been, what's the sister name in it? Is it Stacey?
Stacey Dash?
Yeah. No, no, no. The girl in Sister in Atlanta who ran.
Oh.
Who was one of the contenders.
Oh, gosh.
You know who I'm talking
yes.
about.
Yes. She went for governor.
He would never pick her because she's heavy set and all that. And she looked like a white mm-hmm. woman. And y'all know it's coming. Sisters, please don't kill it. Don't kill the blessing. Lord, I'm praying Jesus right now. Father God, I'm asking you in the name of Lord that the sisters don't kill it with all that negativity. I don't like them pantsuits. And white ladies, y'all need to lay off of her, okay? Just lay off of her. Why she always wearing this? I bet she don't do this. And yap, 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 yap. White ladies too. Y'all lay off that woman, okay? That's why we can't get off the bottom. Women. Lord, y'all's catty, catty, cattiness. Well, I don't like it because I remember when we went to college. And she was all ashy then. She ain't ashy now. I'm just saying. Oh, she done got special now because she's married to a white man. Oh, y'all know it's coming. You know it's coming. Huh? You know, shame. Ooh, now stand and pray on an open mic mm-hmm. on this night now. In Jesus' name. Locally and internationally. In the global network. Jesus, please. Lord, women will never get anywhere because we're going to do it to ourselves. And that's a crying shame. It really is. In today's time, we never had, Lord. Anyway, let's take this time out so I can go to the throne room. I'm going to get ready to pray again. Lord, if I leave. Anyway, let's take the time out and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Good afternoon. The police still on scene of this right here on 24 westbound at 440 24 east at Bell Road. Checking on that accident. Crash in Goodlettsville. Involving injuries. Dickerson Pike at Robert Cartwell Drive. And Mountain View at Crossings Boulevard. That should improve hopefully in a few minutes from that earlier wreck. This traffic report brought to you by Prince's Hot Chicken. 5814 Nolensville Pike. I'm Commander Chuck with your on-time traffic.
Tune in on Thursdays to hear WFSK's Artist of the Week. You can win some brand new music and stay up on the latest smooth and contemporary jazz releases. This week's WFSK Artist of the Week is a spotlight on a new release entitled Ella 100 Live at the Apollo. It celebrates the music and life of the First Lady of Song, Ella Fitzgerald. Hear from Grammy-winning artists Patty Austin and Greg Field. Don't miss the WFSK feature Artist of the Week during the noon hour on Thursdays right here on Jazzy 88, Nashville's Jazz Station.
On my mommy, on the way I dropped it, I I dropped it.
I'm Christian McBride, and this is Jazz Night in America.
Health officials remind everyone to take steps to stop the spread of germs like COVID-19. These include practice social distancing, as defined by the CDC, 6 feet apart. Do not gather in groups larger than 10. Stay at home unless leaving your home is absolutely necessary because you have medical needs or are an essential worker. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Use alcohol-based hand sanitizer if soap and water are not available. Cover your mouth and nose with a tissue when coughing or sneezing. Don't touch the T-zone of your face, your eyes, nose, or mouth. And stay away from others in your home if you are sick. For questions and concerns, contact the COVID-19 hotline at 615-862-7777 from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 7 days a week in both Spanish and English. Again, the COVID-19 hotline is 615-862-7777, 7 to 7, 7 days a week in Spanish and English.
This has been a reminder from community-minded Jazzy 88 WFSK.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, T. Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. We thank you so very much for supporting What's the 411. And this hour, the book of this hour is Hands Up, Don't Shoot. And every time we all think about that, we know exactly what that represents. And it just is ingrained in our hearts, minds, and spirits now. And, you know, this wonderful new resource, this wonderful book is out to remind us the direction and the thought and where we need to be in terms of our heart and our mind. I'm happy to welcome to the show today Associate Professor in the School of Criminal Justice, Jennifer Cobina. She is with me for the first time from, how's Michigan State University doing today, Professor?
It's doing okay. The reality is the vast majority of classes will be taking place online, mm-hmm. but there will be a few students coming on campus where there will be some teaching that takes place on face-to-face.
Okay, so what is your thought on this? I know it's all, you guys last semester were online anyway, right?
Yeah, so when the pandemic hit in March, we immediately, once there was one or two cases that reached Michigan, we stopped classes and everyone had to convert online.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So how what's your preference?
Well, my preference is for me to be online. I will be teaching one course next semester or in the fall, and it's going to be 100% online. I think it's necessary to keep everyone safe.
Okay. So knowing that that's the case, that's a priority for you, of course, but you're keeping yourself safe too. Is it causing you the online, you know, you've lost that personal thing with,
yeah.
And this subject, criminal justice can't get any more personal,
mm-hmm.
and Hands Up, Don't Shoot can't get any more personal. Do you feel like as an educator on heavy and deep subjects such as this one, that online has been effective for your students?
you know, it's certainly a challenge. I think many of us are facing having to deal with these challenges. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly with the advancement in technology, you know, with having Skype and Zoom calls, mm-hmm. Google Teams, you know, FaceTime, you know, we can still see one another, try to create an online learning community where we can still be connected. And so, you know, I think that we can make it work. We have to be creative, right, and be willing to do things differently, but it's not impossible. And I'm always one to certainly prioritize safety. And so I think we can do both. We can prioritize safety while at the same time still educating our students.
Absolutely. Professor Kobina is author of the new book, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter, and How They Changed America. And that is for sure. And I'm very, very happy to have this conversation with you. And Jennifer, you are a alum of the University of Missouri?
Yeah, University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Oh, so that's where you got your PhD?
Yes, it is.
All right, now, go ahead on. In the... Columbia, right?
No, St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, in St. Louis, okay.
Yeah.
Is that the St. Louis campus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I know, I thought the main one was in Columbia.
Yeah, I didn't go there. There's UMSL, University of Missouri, St. Louis is where I attended.
Okay, got you. Okay, are you from there?
I am not, no, but I just went to school there.
Why? If you don't mind me asking, because it's different, criminal justice issues, you know, are different there.
Sure. No, at the time, I mean, it was two reasons. One, at the time, they had offered me the most funding in terms of I received a graduate assistantship, so I didn't have to pay for my school. And of the schools I applied to, they offered the most funding. Mm-hmm. So I was able to complete my degree without going into debt. But number two, and tied to the criminology, is they were also ranked top 10 in criminal justice and criminology within the graduate program. Mm-hmm. So it was a great institution to go to anyways.
I'm sure, because out there, you know, that's the prison industrial complex. That's big business.
It is.
Truly. So, you know, I'm not at all, because I'm from the Midwest, I know, and I'm from the neighboring state of Kansas. So I know another state that, you know, manufactures a lot in the prison industrial complex.
Yes.
And for you, was this to watch these situations play out, and uh-huh. there it was, Ferguson, which is not that far, you know,
right,
from where you were. I mean, that had to be it was on the news every minute, and everybody there was involved in it and all that. Where were you when the situation went down in Ferguson with Michael Brown?
So I was in East Lansing, Michigan, which is where I reside. I live, which is where I live. But you know, when the death of Michael Brown took place, I was concerned. You know, like most people, I had witnessed on television and social media a great demand for social justice mm-hmm. from many of the community members. And what happened in Ferguson felt personal to me because, as you already stated, you know, I had lived in St. Louis while pursuing my doctorate at the University of Missouri, St. Louis for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I lived in a city that was only a couple of minutes away mm-hmm. from Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And so I really cared about what was happening in the area that I had lived in and called home for so many years. Mm-hmm. And so I had an opportunity to contribute, to do something. Once one of my colleagues, he reached out to me and a number of scholars who do social justice work to, you know, he just sent an email. Anyone want to go down to Ferguson and interview and document the experiences of protesters because we were well aware that history was in the making. And so I wrote the book because there was so much to tell and people deserve to hear from the voices of those who are protesting and who are marginalized and feel oppressed.
Yeah. And did you also include the citizens that live in that area that were greatly impacted by this and had lived in it? Since that is such a,
yes.
so that's, you know, that literally is outside of St. Louis, y'all. Seriously, now, just in case you hadn't been down the highway.
So I did conduct. So I conduct nearly 200 interviews with residents of Ferguson and even Baltimore, as well as protesters. So I conduct nearly 200 interviews in Ferguson and Baltimore with residents of both of these cities, as well as protesters at the time of both Michael Brown and Freddie Gray's deaths. Mm-hmm. And these interviews took place within 2 to 3 months of both of these young men's death.
Mm. Wow. So everybody was feeling a certain kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, racial tensions were high. You know, there was anger, there was outrage and frustration, but there was also a lot of fear. You know, in the midst of me doing these interviews, there were a number of people I spoke with mm-hmm. who would break down crying, scared for themselves, scared for their children, mm-hmm. not knowing what would happen, not mm-hmm. knowing if they should move mm-hmm. elsewhere. Because at the time, you know, Ferguson looked like a war zone. I mean, mm-hmm. with the heavy militarization of the police. Mm-hmm. There was just a lot of anxiety and fear, mm-hmm. and even before the decision was made not to indict Darren Wilson, and there was also a lot of concern what would happen mm-hmm. if he wasn't indicted, and many people already pretty much knew he wouldn't be. So, you know, there was, again, outrage, anger, frustration, disappointment, and yet fear and anxiety mm-hmm. as well.
And in your chapter one, Race and Policing, are you giving some historical perspective? Because this stuff is not new with these people doing this stuff with, as far as the law enforcement is concerned. It's ingrained in American history. Is that what chapter one is all about?
Yeah. So, you know, exactly what you said. You know, I definitely make sure to hit quite a bit upon, you know, the history of policing, mm-hmm. You know, because the relationship between Black people and law enforcement has been contentious throughout American mm-hmm. history. Mm-hmm. And while this country was founded on a system of slavery, you know, many people are not aware that the origins of policing in the United States mm-hmm. can be tied to the institution of slavery.
Absolutely.
So, for instance, you know, even in the book, I go on to chronicle how, you know, slave patrols, they were among the first state-sponsored police mm-hmm. force that controlled the slave population. And even when slavery was abolished, states relied on the legal system and the prison system to create policies mm-hmm. that would maintain racial mm-hmm. subordination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For instance, Black codes were established, which created new offenses for certain behaviors, mm-hmm. such as loitering and vagrancy.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who was found in violation of these laws would be punishable by fines, mm-hmm. imprisonment, and forced labor for up to a year, even though slavery at the time was abolished.
Right.
And certainly we know that these laws were discriminatory in nature because they were applied selectively to Black people.
Right.
And then even when Black codes were overturned, Southern states, they pursued racial segregation to maintain white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what led to the proliferation of Jim Crow,
yeah.
which we know are essentially laws, different rules for Blacks and whites, right? Mm-hmm. And so throughout all of this, police were responsible for upholding and enforcing racially discriminatory laws.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to see such acts of racial subordination taking place through mass incarceration, where we know a disproportionate number of Black and Brown people are incarcerated. And so ultimately, you know, from slave patrols to slave codes to Black codes mm-hmm. and Jim Crow laws mm-hmm. and mass incarceration, what we've seen is we've seen racially biased legislation being enforced for several centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the reason why I think it's important to bring up is because the structural legacy of slavery and Jim Crow mm-hmm. continues to shape Black people's position in society.
Absolutely.
And influence how they are treated mm-hmm. by individuals and institutions,
yeah.
including
yeah.
the criminal legal system.
And here's how I know you know your stuff, okay? I'm just saying, okay? This is how I know what she knows what you're talking about. Because I see this chapter, and I'm like, okay, she's on the sister knows. As we were just going back to slavery, and because, you know, people got to realize stuff didn't just happen with uh-huh. Black Lives Matter, okay? That's
yeah.
you know, duh, wrong answer.
Yeah.
back during, but when Black for this is from some research I did personally on family. And that's all I'm going to say on the air about it. But I discovered this, and it was just kind of alarming that when first black police officers and et cetera were actually given the job to be that, the first.
Yeah.
Because black people couldn't have the guns and, you know, things of that nature. So that means the white people had to trust you.
Yeah.
Their main function was just to keep the N-words in line. And they were black. It wasn't white officers doing this. They employed, it was probably some folks just got the check, you know, was glad to get the money to keep everybody in the black community straight. And, you know, and I see in chapter 3, I'm like, look at you, girl. it's a blue thing, race and black police officer. I'm like, look at her. Now, see, now, I mean, because we have been used in this historical picture. Because, you know, everybody that's committing all these things, somebody black has seen it or knows of it.
Yes.
There's a code of silence like crazy. And historically, we were paid and used to keep our folks down. I mean, real. And so when we come back, I want you to talk about that.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, because once people understand, this stuff is in the DNA. We're going to have to do some surgery to get this stuff out of people. It's been
absolutely.
I mean, it's been in them for so long to, you know, it's become like breathing. Wow. Anyway, today's book is Hands Up, Don't Shoot. Lord have mercy, please. Hands Up, Don't Shoot. And I am happy to have in the studio Dr. Jennifer E. Covina, professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. Why the protests in Ferguson and Baltimore matter and how they changed America. Let's take the time out and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
It's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Hello, Nashville. Coming up Sunday morning at 7, news headlines and issues of the day. Then at 7:30, it's the Pastor's Roundtable for the month of August. Guest pastors are Reverend Edward Hill Jr. of Higher Ground Missionary Baptist Church and Reverend David G. Lattimore of 15th Avenue Baptist Church.
That's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay, twice a week, every Sunday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on Jazzy 88 WFSK.
Matthew.
Huh? Oh, sorry.
It's okay. I just need you to listen to me.
I know that a lot of times, Mom, it might not seem like I'm listening to you, but I am. I hear you. And what you say really does matter to me.
I mean, let's be honest. No kid likes rules, but I get why we have them. I hear you, and I know it's because you care.
All the talks we've had over the years, including what you've told me about not using alcohol and other drugs, they stick with me. And believe it or not, they really do make a difference, especially at times that matter most.
Hey, want a drink?
No thanks, I'm good. So thank you, Dad. for talking, and preparing me for what's ahead.
Thanks, Mom, for never giving up and always being my biggest fan.
Thank you for letting me know what you expect, so I can try to meet your expectations.
Thank you for talking!
For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Wearing a mask fights COVID-19.
I'm fighting to keep Tennesseans working.
I'm fighting for time with my friends.
I'm fighting for football on Saturday.
I'm fighting to see my students back in the classroom.
I'm fighting for small businesses.
I'm fighting to keep my family safe.
Until there's a vaccine for COVID-19, it's time for all Tennesseans to fight back by wearing a mask. Face it. Masks fight COVID-19.
Brought to you by the State of Tennessee, Tennessee Association of Broadcasters, and this station.
Meet Keith, loving dad, board game champ, bus driving pro.
I drive 65,000 miles in my bus each year. If people knew what I know, lives could be saved. Like how there are some things I simply can't see. On my route the other day, a car tried to sneak past me and ends up right in my blind spot. I turned slowly, so accident avoided. But no car should be in the blind spot for a 40,000-pound bus.
It's our roads. It's our safety.
Visit www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
This has been a reminder from community-minded Jazzy 88 WFSK.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
Hands up, don't shoot. Why the protests in Ferguson and Baltimore matter and how they changed America. And I am just happy to have Jennifer Cobina on the show this afternoon to discuss her book. And this is an important book that she has written, and professor of criminal justice. And I'm so happy that she's here. You know, y'all were listening to the break, but we were in here talking, okay? We were chatting up. As only, you know, it happens, I'm like, you know. So I just feel like, Jennifer, that, you know, I could talk to you multiple times because I know that you're on point on just so much. Let me go to some of the more of the chapters because I don't want to get caught up. And then the time will be gone.
I think before the break, you had mentioned about, again, the role, you know, black officers, and it's a blue thing, right? Yes. I did want to touch upon that.
Yeah, and the how the history has been for people to get the fact that, you know, it's an issue.
Yeah. So, you know, and I will say that usually when we come across, you know, when these horrible incidents take place where the life of a person is taken by the police, usually where what we go to is, you know, we need to diversify the police force, right? And I've argued many times that diversifying the police force in and of itself is not the answer, mm-hmm. you know, because, I'll say that in amongst the 200 people that I interviewed, 25% did believe that black officers do enforce the law more fairly than white officers and that they're more courteous and respectful. Yet at the same time, another 25% of those who I spoke with, they argue that black officers operate just as aggressively when they come across black civilians. Mm-hmm. And those sentiments, they were much more common among people, among black Baltimoreans who actually had direct encounters with the police. Because at the time of Freddie Gray's death, recall nearly half of the police force was black. The police chief was black. This three of the six officers involved in Freddie Gray's death mm-hmm. was black. Mm-hmm. Yet even the Department of Justice, they conducted their own independent investigation mm-hmm. and they concluded that the Baltimore Police Department, where nearly half the officers are black, but that the Baltimore Police Department engaged in a pattern of unconstitutional, racially biased policing. And, you know, similar results were also found in the Chicago Police Department, where mm-hmm. where just over half of the police force is black. Yet after, you know, after the following the death of Laquan McDonald mm-hmm. by a white officer, the Department of Justice conducted their own independent investigation of the police department in Chicago, and they also concluded that the department engaged in a pattern of unconstitutional policing and racially discriminatory conduct. Mm-hmm. And so, which is why I often argue that You know, diversifying the police force. I'm all for diversity in every arena of life, but let's not fool ourselves into thinking that it will actually result in less police violence, because these are systemic issues, a cultural problem within policing that we're dealing with.
Yeah, that is so true. And, you know, as we were people wanting sweeping change. So when you hear the police reforms or criminal justice reforms and things of that nature, is that what comes to mind, what you wrote in some of the book?
Yeah, so, you know, interestingly, when people talk about reform, again, the low-hanging fruit that most people often go to is we need more implicit bias training. We need more diversity training. We need more cultural sensitivity training and de-escalation training. But the fact of the matter is, you know, police departments have been receiving these types of trainings, right? But we continue to see, you know, black men, women, and children dying at the hands of the police each year. And so there's a few things that I argue, you know, that needs to happen. You know, well, one is we currently spend America spends $100 billion each year on policing and $80 billion on incarceration, where we know that blacks are disproportionately targeted. And so, you know, we know that there have been a lot of calls to reduce the budget within law enforcement, within policing, and shift those funds to more human-centered services to keep our communities safe. So, for instance, that means investing in education, healthcare, housing, and employment opportunities. Because the reality is, you know, we look to the police to solve every societal problem, from issues of abuse, abandonment, homelessness, domestic disputes, school disruption, unemployment, and a host of other societal problems. And so, you know, what I argued in the conclusion section of my book is really, you know, what if we were to, again, actually divest from policing and use those dollars and reallocate them to systems that have been shown to help communities thrive, systems that have been shown to stabilize communities, such as, again, putting funds towards social programs and job opportunities and education. And so, you know, when resources are directed towards stabilizing the community and towards the well-being of black and brown people, that's when we're going to see crime reduced. That's when we're going to see less of a need to rely heavily on policing.
So as far as our community is concerned, and us policing us, because I know this is what this chapter is about. Does diversity training help them at all?
So there's not been any empirical studies that actually show that diversity training actually results in changes to behavior, they can receive the training, but in terms of it actually changing not just attitudes but behavior, we don't see many empirical studies that actually show that. Which is why, again, I've been definitely making a case for the need to, for example, you know, reduce the police budget such that we can divest from having police in schools and instead using those dollars to invest in teachers and counselors. We can divest from criminalizing mental health and instead invest in mental health clinicians and restorative services. We can divest in military weapons against civilians and instead invest in community led harm reduction programs.
No, I was just wondering, you know, it would seem like at some point that if done well, or if we could work our way through some of this, that black officers will be more of a tool in helping than hurting or being aggressive or anything of that nature. They would be more, it would seem like they would be more understanding, but that's not always the case, because that's what you just gave as an example in Baltimore, right?
It's not always the case. You know, again, a lot of this is, some of this might be from the training that they receive, mm-hmm. you know, the culture within a department mm-hmm. that actually promotes targeting and surveilling and using aggressive tactics mm-hmm. on you know, Black people. We know that a lot of Black and brown people live in marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. And yes, in these communities, particularly where we see high rates of poverty yeah. and unemployment, underemployment, lack of resources, not surprisingly, we're seeing crime take place in these neighborhoods. However, that doesn't mean that every resident within these neighborhoods are engaging in criminal activity. Yet because some reside in these neighborhoods or are too poor to actually move, all residents within these neighborhoods are now often viewed with suspicion, often treated with disrespect, and often aggressively targeted, simply because they live in a neighborhood where that's of lower socioeconomic status and high crime.
Now, in both of those communities where the citizens marched and they had had enough, in Chapter 4, you cover why the protesters marched and start with Ferguson here.
Sure.
Was it from years and years of racist behavior and mistreatment by the powers that be in that region? They couldn't take anymore. We've had enough.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, a lot of what I found was that large amounts of people took to the streets because they believed that Michael Brown and Freddie Gray were victims of injustice and that these were not isolated incidents. So either they themselves had been victims of police harassment, surveillance, or violence, or they knew family members, friends, and neighbors who were recipients of these acts by law enforcement. In addition, many people felt an overwhelming obligation to demonstrate. Because they understood that if they didn't hit the streets, they were going to continue to see more Black people dying at the hands of the police. And so that's why about 2/3 of people in my study who protested back then, they were doing so for the first time. The activists that I spoke with, they really desired to achieve change. Mm-hmm. They wanted to put an end to police violence and systemic racism. That's what drove them to protest.
Yeah. Well, that one in particular in Ferguson was like a war zone. I mean, it was
absolutely
just on and on and on and on. So that obviously was pent up. In such an unbelievable manner.
Yeah. And you know, Ferguson received a lot of criticism at the time. You know, the police department received a lot of criticism because of its heavy militarization, right? The use of tear gas, rubber bullets, armored tactical vehicles, the use of police dogs, long-range acoustic rights devices pointed at protesters.
Yeah.
And so what happened in Ferguson, it showed the ways in which local police departments can misuse military weapons to intimidate communities.
Well, it did. It intimidated everybody because you couldn't go to bed. You were watching this saying, oh my God, what are these people getting ready to do?
What's going on? Yeah.
Yeah. So was that the first time that you noticed that heavy armor had come out in a confrontation like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's a contemporary example of the militarization of the police, you know, and which is obviously problematic. We're used to seeing such militarized tactics used in other countries, you know, not on Americans. Mm-hmm. And so we saw this kind of soldier-like mentality.
Yeah.
And we know that soldiers, they're trained to identify people that they encounter as being the enemy, right?
Yes.
And so they often, so many residents, they see them, the police and military gear, as acting as soldiers who are an occupying force. And so this type of besieged mentality, which is created by the militarization of the police, it sends a message to communities that we're not here to protect and serve you.
Right.
You are viewed as the enemy.
Yes.
And you know, a soldier's mission is pretty simple. It is to kill the enemy and try not to kill the non-enemy.
Right, right. And that's why the people are scared to death of them. And as I close up, you know, I know, wow, it's a lot here, it's a lot, that I want to ask you so much. I'm like, now, George Floyd And it wasn't a shooting. It was lynching by knee. Cut his breath off. I can't breathe.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that and what the people experienced? And will you be doing research on that project too?
So, I mean, my thoughts on that, I think just like anyone who view that, it's just such disgust and outrage. You know, to be honest, I couldn't even watch the whole thing. I couldn't watch it until the end where George Floyd took his last breath. It was obvious, you know, the outrage and disgust to see, you know, a man begging for his life, pleading for his life, and even calling for his mother, right? As bystanders are trying to get the other officers' attention, telling them to stop, to stop him, right? And because, you know, he didn't pose a threat. He's arrested on the ground, not posing a threat to the officer. And so, when I watched it, I felt outraged, hurt, upset, angry, thinking, how can this happen? You know, but at the same time, you know, we see now, I mean, a sleeping nation has been awoken, right? Yes. In terms of where we are forcing America to reckon and come to terms with issues of race and racism and white supremacy, because that is what killed George Floyd. Yes. Yeah, and so in terms of, you know, if I'm going to be doing research, I will say, so at the end of August, there's going to be a march in Washington that's being led by Reverend Al Sharpton, which commemorates Martin Luther King's 57th anniversary of I Have a Dream speech. I will be going there. I feel just personally, I'm going to go there for myself. I want to be there. But at the same time, I have also been approved to do a study where I'll be interviewing, you know, people, protesters, people who show up and basically trying to understand, get a further understanding about their perception of the Black Lives Matters movement, what they want to see accomplished, what needs to happen in order to move forward and really reconcile as a country.
Well, I would absolutely be interested in that research when you conduct it because, you know, the shootings, you know, the folks that have been murdered by gun, you know, Freddie Gray's basically couldn't breathe. Eric Garner, George Floyd.
Yeah, so many.
And it's like, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
But I certainly will be, I'm keeping your number, okay? You hear me?
Sure thing.
I certainly am, honey. Dr. Jennifer Cobina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
I've enjoyed it.
Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. And tell the audience where to find your book and keep up with your research.
Sure. They can go on my website, jennifercobina.com. That's www.jennifercobina.com. You can see all the work that I've done, that I continue to do, as well as they can purchase my book on that website as well, www.jennifercobina.com.
Jennifer, thank you so much. And I do look forward to following up with you post going to the march at the end of this month. Thank you so much, okay?
Please do. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
It's really, really, this book is really something, y'all. Hands up, don't shoot. It truly is. And, you know, I just, you know, and I say that about a lot of my books, but, you know, I pride myself on good authors, you know. So don't y'all be calling me saying, "Sure, can't write a book." That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, you know, be sure to check it out. Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Why the Protests in Ferguson and Baltimore Matter and How They Changed America. Nashville, that's all we have for you tonight, ALL. You all have the very best of the best. And don't forget, who loves you?
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.